Real excited about this CNFers promotional. Support for the Creative Nonfiction Podcast is provided by, for a short time, the Power of Narrative Conference out of Boston. It's a craft conference focusing on the genre near and dear to my heart, narrative journalism, taking place March 22nd and March 23rd at Boston University. I attended it a few years ago, and it's a great time. 300 to 400 journalists from around the world will descend on BU, and you can be one of them. Visit combeyond.bu.edu, navigate to the Power of Narrative Conference page, and when you register, use the code narrative25, and you will have 25% off your tuition. This year's keynote speakers include former New York Times editor Dean Baquet, NPR White House correspondent Asma Khalid, The Washington Post John Woodrow Cox, former WAPO editor Marty Baron, and the team behind the Boston Globe's Murder in Boston, The Untold Story of the Charles and Carol Stewart Shooting. Not only that, but there will be 15 breakout sessions worth attending, including crafting climate change stories, writing a braided narrative, and the power of empathy in reporting. Learn more at combeyond.bu.edu and use the narrative25 code for 25% off. Again, narrative25 to save 25% off at combeyond.bu.edu. Repairing, restoring, reconnecting through true storytelling. I like the sound of that.
When I get to like the fourth adjective in a sentence, you know, that's in the fourth adjective and the third adverb, that's when I'm like, I'm doing the rock critic thing again. And that's when I get the urge to just go, bruh. And that's, you know, I'm so relieved that that is amusing to even one other person.
Oh, hey, CNFers, it's the Creative Nonfiction Podcast, the show where I speak to badass people about telling true stories. I'm Brendan R. O'Mara. The R stands for reprehensible. Rob Harvilla, staff writer, staff podcaster for The Ringer, is back on the show. He first came on the show during the mighty early run of his hit podcast, 60 Songs That Explain the 90s. It's still mighty, where we talked about the stealth memoir of it all. This past holiday season, you see we're nothing if not punctual. Rob released the book 60 Songs That Explain the 90s, and it's a great companion with some pretty amazing artwork inside. It's published by 12, who also published The Ringer's Claire McNear's Answers in the Form of Questions book about Jeopardy, and I'm starting to think there's a connection there. The show started with 60, then went to 90, and it will end with its 120th song this week, or next week, or last week, or today, or tomorrow, or yesterday. I don't know when you listen to this, but either way, it ends. And the timing of this interview that I recorded back before Thanksgiving, it's been a tough year, seems apropos. I've always wanted to be the kind of person who could use apropos and not fuck it up, and I think I did. Who died and made you the grammar police? Rob marries the personal with the rock critical in his podcast. I had reached out to Rob for a revisit about a year and a half ago, and that got kicked down the road somewhat, and then I got wind of the book, and that seemed apropos, yes! So I wanted to dig into the maze-like quality of the later episodes. At times, it takes Rob upwards of 20 minutes for him to, one, reach the title song and artist, and fully announce who he is, as if you already didn't know. And I love following him as he navigates the labyrinth. Like, I rub my hands together, and I'm like, okay, Rob, you're starting here, and you gotta take us to there. How are you gonna do it? It's a great joy for me. Courtney Love reached out to him sometime after she got wind of his doll parts episode, and she called him a stentorian voice doodly bro. You didn't think I made the title up to this episode by myself, did you? Be sure you're heading over to brendanomera.com for show notes and to sign up for my monthly Rage Against the Algorithm newsletter. It's a toe-tapping good read. First of the month, no spam. As far as I can tell, you can't beat it. Probably can. For now, keep the conversation going on Instagram and Threads at Creative Nonfiction Podcast, and consider becoming a patron at patreon.com/CNFpod. I get it. Don't I get it? money's tight, and the joy you get from, say, I don't know, spending $4 on a coffee often is far more gratifying than, say, $4 a month on your favorite podcast. But if you can, check it out. And I just put out a call for office hours to talk about whatever you want to talk about, one-on-one. That's for the $4 and up crowd. Okay, but listen, though. Here's my semi-requisite shout-out to Athletic Brewing, my favorite non-alcoholic beer out there. If you use BrendanO20 at checkout, you get 20% off your order if you visit athleticbrewing.com. They are not a sponsor of the show, and I don't get any dough. I just get skee-ball tickets, and I love celebrating what they do. All righty. Here's Rob Harvilla. One more song to go. Oh, my gosh. Stay tuned for my parting shot at the end. And this is it. Rob is going to be sailing off into the gray havens, starting now. Riff. We're good, man. Yeah, it's a trip. This has got to be just such a wild time for you. The fact that this podcast has been really a multi-year project, and it's like kind of culminating in the souvenir book. And what has this experience been like for you? Of like the last, you know, as the book became something came on your radar, I guess.
I really like the phrase souvenir book quite a bit. You know, like this is the giant foam, you know, index finger of the podcast, and I'm really digging that image, honestly. Okay, sorry. Yep. Yes, it's very strange. It feels like several decades since this show began, you know, in the depths of the pandemic, right? Like it started in October 2020. I was thinking about it, talking about it all through the summer of initial lockdown. You know, my daughter was born on Halloween 2020. You know, I can look at her as like a visual reference for how long I've been doing this show, right? And now she's like very tall and yelling at me, and it's just so disconcerting that it's gone on this long. But when we started to think about the book, I thought it would be so easy, right? Because I write a script every week, you know, that's some absurd quantity of words, right? It started out as 2,000 words. Now it's much closer to 9,000 per episode. I got 600,000 words of raw material. And I'm like, this book is going to be so easy. I'm just going to cut and paste. And then, like, I had to distill literally 600,000 words into a readable, like actually liftable, like book form, right? Yeah. And how am I going to condense everything into an actual book that people can read and also carry around?
Given that there isn't an easy way to cut and paste everything you've done, because then you structure it in such a way in the book, be it ending with, say, like big feelings, or like starting closer with like selling out or not, and so the diaspora of the show. It's like, okay, how are these all going to fit into these little boxes that make it readable on the page versus what we're experiencing through the ear?
Yeah, I mean, explain in the title of the podcast was always my little joke, right? You know, because I did not come into this show, and I am not going to exit this show with a grand unified theory of the 90s, right? Like, I can't really explain it. I don't think there is a one-sentence explanation. And I think that's what's beautiful about it, is the chaos of it. And so the book, in addition to being this radical, you know, simplification of 3 years of work or whatever, it is also trying to get these songs interacting with each other in new and unexpected ways, you know, and trying to figure out, you know, what are the different kinds of selling out? There's the Green Day type of selling out. There's the Metallica type of selling out. There's, you know, the Coolio, you know, concern that he had about selling out, you know, to suddenly have this suburban and largely white audience. You know, what does that do to his music? What does that do to him? You know, my friend Stephen Jenkins from Third Eye Blind, who so many of his bandmates and so many of his fellow rock stars seemed to actively dislike, you know, he was just such a great villain for the late 90s, right? Like just a very popular but very punchable presence. And so it gets me thinking about different kinds of adversity, like within bands, like Oasis, the Gallagher brothers fighting with each other, you know, Brandy and Monica, the boy is mine, you know, just there's just years, decades now of enmity supposedly between them based on this song, the popularity of this song, you know, that culminates with them doing one of those versus beat battles, right? Which is like such a COVID era idea, you know, and that it just sort of viscerally carried through from the 90s to now, like the journey that I've been on.
Yeah. And in the acknowledgments, you know, right off the bat, you know, you write that I'm struggling with the finality of the whole book process, quite frankly. And take us to that struggle.
Oh, I am living that struggle right now. That struggle is audible in my voice. I mean, the very, very, very funny joke of this show, right, is that 60 is in the name, and I approached 60 songs, and I was like, I can't stop yet. There's too many other songs. Can you please let me do more? And they're like, fine. And so we go up to 90, but we don't change the name of the show because that would, like, ruin the SEO. Like, that would damage the brand, right? And that makes it easier for me when we approach 90 to be like, I still don't want to. Can I do 120? And they're like, oh, God. Like, this is it. You cannot do more. It's like, fine. So now we're doing 120. But I have a huge issue with the finality of both the show and the book. The physical nature of the book and, as you know, at the finality of it is just tripping me out. You know, there's something so fluid about the show to me in that it is week to week, you know, in that, you know, it also sort of encompasses like my dumb tweets or whatever. For there to be a book that is like a body of work, quote unquote, that I cannot change now, even though I'm finding like typos in it, you know, like I'm really struggling with that idea. But I think that's a manifestation of the larger issue, which is that I don't want the show to end. You know, the show has to end. You know, I think it's to honor the show and the idea of the show and the idea that there is a number in the title of the show, even if it is now inaccurate. Like, the show has to end. There has to be finality, but that doesn't mean I have to like it.
For sure. Yeah, that's really well put. And it is a show that probably could go on for, you know, you cite, like, with apologies to 200 other songs that you would like to do.
Yes.
But at some point, in service of the audience and probably your own sanity, having a definitive
in that order.
End.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just like, you know, it's kind of like the Breaking Bad guys. You know, they could have gone for another couple seasons, but they're like, you know what? Five is good, and this will tell the story and leave people
there
wanting
we go.
More.
Right. That's exactly. I want Breaking Bad and not necessarily like Seinfeld, I guess, if we want to make a 90s reference. Yeah.
I wanted to get a sense of the working relationship that you have with your producers, too, like with specifically Justin Sales. On the, you know, just in developing an episode and an arc of when you like return after a hiatus of sorts. So what's the kind of dialogue that you guys are having as you're looking to, you know, bring more episodes to light?
I mean, he's been there from the beginning. He's been crucial to this from the beginning. You know, he had been my editor for probably about a year prior. You know, my first editor, I've been at The Ringer now since it launched. It's 7 years, easily the longest I've been at one job. And Amanda Dobbins was my first editor, and she was fantastic. You know, but then I started working with Justin, and it's been great, you know. And so he's there from the very beginning as we're talking through what the show is, as we land on the 90s, you know, as the framework for the show itself. You know, he's shared on the Google Docs where we have 300 songs that are possibilities, you know, and as I start putting them in order, as I start getting guests, you know, and then editing, Justin Sales has read so many words that I have written. Justin Sales has read, it's approaching a million words. And that is just a terrible thing to do to somebody.
<That's insane.
laughs> To make them read 1 million words that you've written over the course of, you know, probably all told 4 or 5 years now. And I feel very bad about that. But he's been crucial to every aspect of the show from the beginning. And, you know, one aspect of that is song choice, you know, and in trying, there's no rhyme or reason to the order, right? These are not ranked in any sense. You know, to go from Alanis Morissette to the Gin Blossoms to the Wu-Tang Clan to Missy Elliott and on and on and on, like, that's just a measure of trying to keep it interesting, trying to keep it broad, trying to keep it surprising. But, like, he's involved in every decision made about this show, I guess, including when to stop and when to start again.
Let's say I would say, for as a longtime listener of the show, I think that we can all agree, like, your wheelhouse is kind of like the more grunge bands, you know, of your
sure.
your Soundgardens and so forth. Not that that's your exclusive taste, but that, you know, we all have kind of wheelhouses. And when you have to mm-hmm. branch out to other artists that you might respect and admire but aren't as familiar with, but you want to give them the respect they deserve in their own particular episode, you know, what are some of the steps that you ensure that you're giving, you know, fill in the blank, that artist the same degree of attention and analysis?
I think the first step is to be honest about it, you know, and the binary, the way I look at it is, it, did I listen to this when I was a teenager or didn't I? And that's the measure by which grunge becomes my wheelhouse, right? Because I grew up listening to Pearl Jam and Nirvana and Alice in Chains and Soundgarden and on and on and on. Like, I was a meat and potatoes alternative rock kid. I just bought in to a degree that you cannot believe, you know, and that doesn't mean that I listened, you know, to zero rap, R&B, pop, metal, whatever, whatever, whatever. But it's my relationship with those genres as a teenager, as a kid, is different, you know, and so much of this show is predicated on the idea that, like, the music you loved as a teenager is so precious to you, and it's a different relationship with music than you'll have with any other music ever in your life. And so when I get to an episode that's about Selena, say, or Chumbawamba, even, you know, other than mm-hmm. Tub Thumping, like, I had no prior familiarity with Chumbawamba. I was vaguely aware they were anarchists. I was only vaguely aware that they had, like, this giant, daunting catalog discography of, like, 8-10 records that precedes, you know, the Tub Thumping record. And so the first step for me, just for myself, but also in the show, in the script itself, is, like, I don't outright say, you know, I didn't grow up listening to this. I didn't know this until very recently, but, like, just trying to be honest about my biases and my wheelhouses, you know, and what I know and what I don't know. Like, Selena means so much to the people who grew up with Selena, alongside Selena, you know, and the tragedy of her death is such a visceral, painful memory for those people, and I can appreciate that, but that's not the same thing as having lived it in real time. I just try and be honest both with myself and with the listeners about, like, what I can lay claim to on a personal level and what's a little hard, what I can't lay claim to, and I got to find another way in, you know what I mean?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's I imagine, because if you are particular, you know, like you said, with your, you have a vocabulary with your wheelhouse bands that you can almost don't even have to Google anything. You can just pretty much write off the cuff.
I don't need to listen to those records ever again. I love them and I enjoy listening to them. But, you know, what I say is, like, for example, like, the Downward Spiral is playing in my head right now. You know, it's at a volume that I can't really hear it necessarily, but I do not need to listen to that album again to hear it. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. And I think when I started knocking on your door again to talk, it might have been, you know, somewhere around last summer or a couple summers ago at this point. And it was what struck me as the evolution of the show was, was evolving, to be redundant. I'm sorry. I was struck by the puzzle of an episode, and, like, I think I phrased it as, like, the maze, and at the start, and it was specifically what really triggered this in me was the Sabotage episode with Beastie Boys. Now you start with Warrant's right. Cherry Pie.
Warrant.
And
yes.
And it's just like, I'm always, I listen in part, I'm like, how is Rob going to pull it back to the title episode? And how did that just maybe start to develop in you as a means to start talking about, in this example, Sabotage?
I think the foundation of that evolution is just, frankly, the length of the show itself, right? You know, and it's like the Alanis Morissette episode number one is 2,000 words, the script, right? The Cardigans mm-hmm. episode, which is whatever, 108, is like 8,500 words. So first of all, this thing got like 3, 4, 5 times longer. And so I think what started to creep in was that idea of a digression or just like a labyrinth of associations that brings me from some random point to the song I'm talking about, you know. And the Beastie Boys episode, I don't think I've done it very often where it's like a very cute sort of fake out thing where I start talking about like they were so worried that this one hit would define them, you know, and mm-hmm. they thought they were so smart, but the song is so dumb, and they thought everyone would understand that they were smart and they were very smartly making a dumb song, but everyone took the dumb song seriously and now they're bound to it forever. And then I play Cherry Pie. Right. You know, everybody yeah. assumes the idea anyway is that people will think I'm going to play Fight for Your Right to Party and that's the Beastie Boys. But we start with Cherry Pie. And I don't know if there's ever been that explicit an example of a fake out sort of intro. But it did just get to the point where I thought about a song and I just tried to imagine a route to get to the song that I don't start with the song necessarily. And I do every once in a while just to mix it up, like the Macarena. Right. Like I just. Let's just play the Macarena and get on with it, right? But, you know, for a lot of these other ones, whether it's a personal connection, you know, in which case there's no way, unless you know me, you know, you're going to understand why I'm talking, you know, about going to basketball practice or whatever in 1994. Like, you don't know why I'm talking about this unrelated thing, but I'm going to hopefully make it clear to you. Or if there's sort of like a genre connection that makes a little more sense, I guess I did just get to a point where part of the fun of the show is constructing that labyrinth, you know, and that series of associations that magically leads you, you know, to Lisa Loeb or whatever.
At what point did you realize that you could start to take it from the 2,000 words, say, from episode one, and really start to push the limits of that boundary? You know, when did you get comfortable with that?
I think part of it was the feedback I was getting. You know, this show is by far the best, you know, response I've ever gotten anything that I've ever done. And part of that I put down, and you know this well, to the parasocial nature of podcasting, right? You know, just something about my voice in people's ears, in people's cars, you know, as they wash the dishes, you know, there's an intimacy, you know, and there's a friendship, like a bond that ideally forms. Like I do it with plenty of podcasts, and to some extent, maybe people are doing it with me and mine. And so these emails that I get, right, and it's they're very kind, but what they want to do mostly is just tell me their own stories. You know, they're proposing that I do an episode, you know, on Harvey Danger. You know, and they explain why, because when they were a teenager, this and that happened, and this Harvey, you know, it was so important to me, this song. And it's, I love those emails, right? And it's, I love that, you know, my mundane, personal, suburban Ohio stories that virtually nobody can relate to, like literally, like nobody knows what I'm talking about when I talk about 107.9 The End, the alternative rock radio station in the Cleveland era. It's the greatest radio station ever. Like nobody's listened to that unless they've lived or driven through Cleveland. But the idea is it just gets you thinking about your own hometown radio station, right? And what songs you heard there that you loved and what CDs you bought and whatever, whatever, whatever. It's the old saw about the more specific a song is, the more universal it becomes. You know, that's the principle just applied to me now talking about those songs. And so I guess that feedback that I was getting and the idea that the show was connecting, and what was connecting was in some degree, to some degree, the digressions and the more personal stories and the longer, more winding road, you know, to Yellow Ledbetter or whatever. Like, it got me to the idea that, like, you know, the long digression could be like the actual thing, right? Like the song is important, but how you get to the song and why the song is so important to you is just as important.
I'm thinking especially of late of the Black Hole Sun episode, and it, you know, it's just popped into my head, and it was like, you know, you start with, I believe, you know, Smash Mouth and move into like Blind Melon, and you know, was that a way for you to shoehorn extra songs in that you're like they might not deserve their own episode, but here's a way we can get these 90s songs in and under the umbrella of this Titanic 1994 hit.
I think you got me there. Deserve is such a squirrely word, right? Because I Blind Melon, you know, No Rain absolutely deserves, you know, deserved an episode all on its own. You know, it's deserved is in the eye of the beholder. You know, that's the entire point of the show. But it is absolutely true that as I sit here, you know, at the sound, at the point of Soundgarden with like 15 episodes, 15 songs left to go. Now I'm at like 10. Dude, like 11 or 10. And it's terrible. It's a terrible, 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 terrible feeling to look at this Google Doc, you know, of 50 songs that I want to do episodes on. And I'm looking at 11 blank spots and I'm just like, oh, shit. And so I do think there is an impulse lately, you know, as we ramp up to our dramatic conclusion, you know, hopefully it doesn't feel that shoehorned, but undeniably kind of it is shoehorned. Like, it's just, I want to, where can I fit these guys in? And the Soundgarden episode is odd for a few reasons. First, it was like the first one back, right? I had been on break, you know, to deal with a book for a couple months. And so you sort of want to come back. I think it's, you know, I don't know numbers. I don't follow stats. You know, I'm very blessed, you know, very privileged to not worry about that. And so, but I have a sense, certainly, that the alternative rock episodes tend to do a little better, you know, or get a little more of a response. You know, your Pearl Jam, your Nirvana, of course, stuff like that. And I don't know if that's a reflection of the Ringer audience in particular, or if that's just the way it goes or what. But we want to come back with a bang, you know, quote unquote. We think Soundgarden. But Steve Harwell, you know, from Smash Mouth had died, you know, during that break, you know, quite unexpectedly, you know, and so I'm reading all these very tender tributes to him. I've got him in my head. I went through a run, you know, I'm getting all this feedback. Like, there, it felt like a coordinated Blind Melon campaign. I'm not going to rule out that there was some sort of astroturfed, like, super PAC where they all got together and, like, pretended to independently email me about Blind Melon, but it was all very tightly coordinated. I just started getting a lot of Blind Melon emails, you know, and it's like, that's a great idea. Like, I love getting suggestions and they're all great ideas. And that's why I have a Google Doc that terrifies me. But there was just a run of Blind Melon, you know, and it's so grim to say, but I knew the Soundgarden episode was going to be heavy because of Chris Cornell dying, you know, and he died like 3 days before I was going to go see him in Columbus. And I had never seen Soundgarden live before. And I was so excited and I was extra devastated to hear that he was gone. And so now you have, I'm sort of in a eulogy mindset as part of the Soundgarden episode. Then Steve Harwell dies, you know, and I want to try and honor him, you know, and then Blind Melon, unfortunately, slides into that. Like, I try not to think in those terms too often, in terms of like stringing tragedies together. But it was just curious to me the way the sudden, you know, shocking death of a front man, of a rock star, changes the way you hear their songs, you know, the way No Rain overnight when Shannon Hoon passed became like this beautiful, you know, eulogy, you know, that it was just, it's such a heavenly sounding song already, No Rain, and he appears to be at peace, you know, just your mind starts spinning in that way, you know, to hear All Star, which is such like a silly song and such an aggressively memed song, and like, it's not a joke, or if it's a joke, it's a joke they're in on, but there's just such a complicated like two online aura around All Star and around Smash Mouth as a whole, and then all of that is brought to a screeching halt by his death, you know, and you're suddenly confronted by this very human tragedy, you know, and you've been making Shrek memes about it for 10 years. And you're like, oh, my God, like, just that was just all swirling around in my head. And I tried to harmonize all of that, you know, without getting too grim about it.
Oh, yeah. And there in that episode as well, which is kind of a great connective tissue, is the necklace that Chris Cornell wears. And I believe in the
right.
Black Hole Sun video was given to him by Shannon Hoon. And it's like, you know, that's a great way. Did you know that going in? Like, how long had you known that? And was that something that just was pure serendipity, or like, oh, here's a great way to connect these two here?
Oh, it was serendipity. You know, it was I had already put them together, and if I'm fairly certain I had already written the Smash Mouth part, which led into the Blind Melon part, and I was somewhere deep into the Blind Melon part of like writing and still like reading stuff feverishly as I'm writing, where I stumble across that. I'm like, yes, validation. And like the cool, what I should do is tell you that I knew it the whole time, I guess, or maybe it's cooler that, you know, I sensed it, you know, with my spidey sense, so that there was this beautiful connection between Chris Cornell and Shannon Hoon. And then it manifested, you know, in the necklace. It's like a Denny's fork that Shannon Hoon sort of twisted into a necklace. Like, even that image is like very profound to me as a former Denny's waiter. You know, it's such a legitimately beautiful thing.
Well, that's what's terrifying about writing, you know, writing anything, you know, when you feel like you're doing so much research and you feel like you've done enough, or you're panicked that you haven't done quite a bit. And then you're writing along and then you stumble across something. You're like, oh my God, I thought I turned over every stone. And then you find out there are stones you didn't even know were there. And you're like, God damn it. There are now new stones. I didn't know they were there.
Yeah. Oh, of course. You know, I've never flattered myself for one second. You know, the explains part of this show and this book is a joke, right? You know, like I've never flattered myself for a second that I'm, you know, 5% comprehensive on even the bands I've been listening to all my life, right? You know, like I think it's a matter of just amassing enough research, you know, enough personal history, you know, and, you know, I build enough of a labyrinth to get through it, but I'm never going to know everything. And I'm inevitably, you know, 3 months later, going to stumble across like the perfect quote or the perfect antidote. You know, like what would usually happen is I would find out about the spoon necklace, you know, tomorrow. And I would be like, oh shit. It's very fortunate that I found that when I did, but it's far more likely, you know, that I find these serendipitous things way too late.
There's a moment in the Beastie Boys, the Sabotage episode. It's such a subtle thing you did, but it probably made me laugh harder than any other thing you've ever said over the entire run of the podcast. It was right at the start. And it's when you make the Fight Club reference. You're like, that's a Fight Club reference. Speaking of failed attempts to satirize macho bullshit that instead inspired a bunch of extra macho bullshit. But then you just go blah and keep going. When you go blah, that moment right there is the encapsulation of the entire podcast for me.
Oh my God. That's very kind of you to say. And yes, blah, you know, the combination, like to put it in comic strip terms, it's like half Kathy, it's half like Ack, and it's half like Charlie Brown, ugh. Like that's the blah for me. You know, I end up using that word, or I just go blah, 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 when I hear myself being a rock critic. You know, like they're coruscating riffs, like blah, 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 blah. Like what I wanted from this show from the beginning is to avoid, you know, my rock critic voice, you know, which I always worried was calibrated to be only audible to other rock critics. You know, I'm going to write this awesome 1200 word review of this Lana Del Rey record, but unless you know every single detail about the career and discography of Lana Del Rey up to this point, you are not going to be cool enough to get all these sweet references and inside jokes I'm making. That is precisely what I wanted to avoid here, and I hope I'm successful at that. But part of that is when I find myself, when I get to like the fourth adjective in a sentence, you know, that's in the fourth adjective and the third adverb, that's when I'm like, I'm doing the rock critic thing again. And that's when I get the urge to just go, bruh. And that's, you know, I'm so relieved that that is amusing to even one other person. That's very gratifying. Thank you.
It's part of the Harvillian cadence I've come to like adore there about the whole thing. But you bring up a great point about the rock critic voice. And that was something I wanted to to talk to you about, because I imagine that at some point over a rock critic's career, a music critic's career, you're writing to impress other rock critics instead of like serving the readers who might want to just enjoy the music. And I wonder like how you have wrestled with that.
Oh, that's been my fear from the beginning, you know, and especially, you know, I worked at the Village Voice, right, from I think 2006, 2011. So I'm in my late 20s. I've worked at a couple alt weeklies. You know, there's been a bunch of ugly corporate takeovers. You know, it's a pretty gnarly situation. And I'm just sort of flown in. You know, I'm just a dude from Ohio suddenly let loose in the big city, you know, and trying to edit Bob Christgau. And everybody's just looking at me like, what the hell? And in that moment, you know, running the Paz and Jop poll, which is this revered, you know, just so historical and important year-end critics poll that sort of distills, you know, a year of critical knowledge and consensus into one poll and all these essays. And it's legitimately was so important to me, and it terrified me. And that exacerbated, magnified this sense, as you say, exactly, that I'm writing to rock critics and not to like my mother-in-law. You know, my mother-in-law is so sweet and so awesome and so supportive, and she'll read, you know, this cool Lana Del Rey review that I did, and she'll be like, that was really good article, Rob. I was like, yes, thank you. She's like, I didn't understand any of it. I have no idea what you're talking about, but I'm sure it was very astute. It's like, oh, crap, you know? And so that's exactly what I wanted to avoid. But the second part of it, just as crucial, is that I have to say this shit out loud. You know what I'm saying? Like, what they tell you as a writer is to read it out loud and you will see the problem immediately. And so the impulse that I have as a writer to write these 200 word convoluted sentences, you know, full of semicolons and em dashes and parentheses, you know, the fact of having to read it out loud immediately, I think, and I can sort of tell just reading over even the earliest scripts, is like it simplified my writing and improved my writing, I think. And that helped me also make my writing more accessible, you know, to people who don't do this for a living.
You know, it gets to the point of voice too. And, you know, quite literally you're putting this down on tape. And over the course of the run of the show, in what ways have you noticed that your voice became more, you know, refined or polished over the course?
That's a very funny word. First of all, I don't know if you can hear, but my 3-year-old daughter just wandered in here, so that will make this a more exciting experience. All right, now I'm also caught on a... Okay, here we go. How have I gotten more refined is the question.
Well, I guess, you know, to put it in something that feels less highfalutin, it's like, a guitarist has like evolves their own sort of their sound, their own tone, and that feels unique to them. And I guess just over the course of doing this, you know, you're at a natural starting point, and then over the course, you're like, you're starting to find more of a grounding in your own voice over the course of several years. And so I guess that's kind of more or less what I'm referring to.
No, I understand. And so from the very beginning, I understand academically that it's, you know, the process of writing the first script for Alanis Morissette, you ought to know, like I open a Google Doc and I type some words into it. You know, this is familiar to me. You know, I know how to do that, but I understand that I'm going to have to read it out loud, you know, and I think I understand what that means and how it changes things. But of course, I don't grasp the fullness of it. And part of that is, again, the feedback, you know, the realization that people are going to hear my voice in their earbuds or in their cars or while they mow the lawn or whatever. It took me a very...
As some of you like to know, I do occasionally interject when I feel like I have something germane to say. Rare as that is. Rob saying about the mowing of the lawn and so forth. I remember like what's kind of cool about his podcast is at times I remember where I was at a certain time when I was listening to a particular one. Like I was actually cutting the grass in the backyard listening to the Fiona Apple episode on Criminal. And I remember cleaning up dozens of piles of dog shit during the Regulators episode. So, you know, there are these things. There are the little GPS coordinates that you remember when you're listening to a podcast, specifically 60 songs that explain the 90s. Okay, back to Rob.
Now sort of fully wrap my head around that, like the direct conduit from this, from my head to this microphone to other people's ears. It's just a very foreign concept to me even now. And it's not a discomfort, but I do think that there's like a healthy sort of bewilderment that I continue to have about that. But if I go back, and I did, you know, to research this book, I reread all my scripts, and I can tell that I'm getting more comfortable, or I'm sort of understanding far beyond like the rock critic, you know, avoiding rock critic uber adjective talk, you know, like I finding a more conversational tone, you know, and trying performing it without it feeling performative, you know, like I'm not, monologue is such a dorky word, but like I'm not an actor, you know, I'm not performing per se, but I do think that, you know, blah is not something that I put in print too often, but that's an example of something where I'm like, I think this may actually help, you know, and change the tone of the thing if it feels like I'm actively struggling with what I'm saying as I'm saying it. Like, I could make it more conversational in a way that felt natural to me. Like, I don't want to laugh at my own jokes ever, you know, but I do when I find something somebody else said funny, you know, and I laugh at it organically when I read it out loud, even if I've heard it 200 times. Like, does that sound on the other end to the listener sincere? Does it sound like I'm fake laughing? Like, all that kind of thing. Just sort of understanding that, like it or not, there is a performative aspect to this, and just trying to find a way to do that that felt natural to me and sincere. You know, it's a process and it continues, but I can tell just reading the scripts and how sort of conversational and jocular the scripts started getting that I did at least realize, you know, that I'm on this path and that evolution is happening.
Has a critic of anything, let's just say rock critics, have they ever fundamentally changed your relationship to music you loved, and actually, like, you're like, oh shit, they kind of ruined it for me?
Has anyone ruined anything for me? You know what I really don't like, and I do this all the time, is like the construction of, like, you know, Pearl Jam are older now than the Who were when Pearl Jam first came out. You know what I mean? Like, the fact that, you know, the 60s were as far away from us in the 90s. I hate that shit, man. And I do that all the time. But I do not need to be reminded of how old I am, you know, and that the music that I loved as a kid is now definitionally classic rock. You know, I don't need that. I don't think that anyone has ruined anything. You know, I think it's gone the other way. It has deepened my appreciation over time. You know, I find myself talking a lot lately about Janet Jackson, you know, who I revered as an MTV superstar when I was a little kid watching MTV. And I was so mad for so long that, like, Escapade was an 80s song, you know, and that I had a personal spiritual relationship with Janet Jackson's 80s stuff, and I didn't have that with the 90s. What I had was, like, the rock critic praise for her. I understood that The Velvet Rope was, like, her best reviewed album in some ways, and, like, her deepest, her densest, her darkest, you know, her most sophisticated piece of work. But I didn't feel that on a personal level the way I felt Control, right? Because I was a kid then and my relationship was fundamentally different. But over the course of finally doing the Janet Jackson episode that I'd been scared to do for so long, and doing Together Again and diving into The Velvet Rope, I had this knowledge, all these wonderful writers, you know, the 33 and a third book on it, you know, these critics I admire who had been praising that record for years and who had been telling me for years that this is such a wonderful record and very arguably the best record of her career. I finally got it, you know, on a personal level in addition to a critical level, you know, and that's a lot of writers, a lot of critics, you know, doing a lot of unpaid work on my behalf for years and years and years and years. But like, it finally did happen. And I'm so grateful to all of them, you know, for helping me finally come to that realization.
Yeah, I think of the note that you made. We talked about Metallica a lot the last time, and how Lars's drumming was like falling down the stairs. And that I can't hear his drumming now without that image. And there's a song on their new album called Too Far Gone, and it is the apotheosis of stair falling drumming. It is.
Oh, that's so exciting, though. As soon as we're done talking, I'm going to go listen to that, though, because I'm in the mood for a falling down the stairs with Lars experience.
You got it.
Man, I dig it.
I wanted to get a sense of, you know, how you approach interviewing, too. And I admire how you go about asking questions. I'm a work in progress as an interviewer, as you can tell. And it's a lot of interviewers tend to be very bloated in the way they ask questions. And I feel like you get to the point really quick and don't ask or don't answer the question on behalf of the guest and then ask the question again. You know, just how did you develop just a good interviewing sort of cadence?
I'm frankly relieved that you think it's a good interviewing cadence. That's also very validating to you, to me, and I thank you very much. The interviewing part worried me for a long time. It kind of still does. You know, like if comparing the interview to the monologue, I always felt more comfortable. I think I will always feel more comfortable with the monologue. You know, I think the interviews have improved over time. And what I'm trying to do, and I'm very great, is what you're describing, right? Like, I think it's partly a function of, I have now talked about this song for 9,000 words in like 45 minutes. I have exhausted, you know, my take, you know, please somebody else say something. And so I think that makes me even more reticent than usual to like talk over the person I'm interviewing. You know, I just want to hear their perspective. And that's been true from the beginning. I think the thing I struggled with so much at the onset, and like I can go back and listen to the monologues of, say, the first 10 episodes, but no way am I doing the interviews, right? Because my concern with the interviews is it sounds so stiff to me. You know, I'm reading the questions. You know, I was interviewed by a dude here in Columbus in person. You know, we're at a coffee shop, right? And there's a recorder between us, the classical thing. And I've been in that situation interviewing people plenty of times. And I've always struggled to not have a list of questions in front of me because my memory doesn't work very well, right? Like I can't remember the questions I want to ask. And so I have this cheat sheet, but now I'm sitting across from a person and I keep looking at this piece of paper and then going, yeah, it was cool when you did. And I'm reading the question word for word, and that's terrible, right? Like there's a difference between an interview and a conversation to me. And so I think the arc of this show from the interview perspective is getting me from interview to conversation, you know. And what I can say with some confidence is that it's better. Now I feel less stiff, you know, I feel less like I'm reading the questions word for word, you know, I'm trying to just listen to what they say. And ideally the next question comes not from my piece of paper, but from what they're saying now, right? Like just trying to make it more of a conversation has been everything to me.
Yeah, that's a great way of putting it. And I've likened it to like I have a series of notes. I have a screen up with things that are like some bullet points, and you know, right. I'm always scribbling like things down, like putting a pin in something. I'm like, oh, that's cool. I like how so and so said that. I might circle back to that. I kind of equate it to like an NFL call sheet. It's like here are all the plays, you know, and it's like depending on the situation. Oh, it's third and long. We got to go to this one. Oh, it's fourth and one. We're going to go for it. We're, you know, let's.
That's right. This is the tush push question. No, I dig it.
This is the brotherly shove time. Exactly. Yeah.
It's brotherly shove. I hadn't heard that one. That's
oh,
good.
You haven't
that's
heard that one yet? Good. All right. Nice.
I have not. It's been tush push. I don't think I've seen that actually. I've just read about it on the internet. You know, like I've watched Eagles games like in the background as I'm cleaning the house or whatever, but I don't know that I've ever been looking straight at a television when a tush push occurred. I don't know exactly what transpires there, but I'm very interested, of course.
Yeah, if NFL games were on Saturday, my wife and I would have a drinking game. But anytime you hear tush push, you had to take a drink. Thankfully, we'd be too hungover on a Monday, so we can't do it on
Sunday.
You'd
be drunk, yes. Yeah.
Exactly. And it's just kind of still piggybacking on interviewing. And I think you've probably spoken and thought a lot about the, you know, having Courtney Love on the show, and she is a force. And there is
yes,
there is no getting a word in edgewise most of the time with her. Well, I listened to her on Marc Maron, and he just let her go.
Yep.
And likewise, you know,
he was hilarious.
Yeah,
I listened to that before I talked to her, and his approach, he's just going, yep, 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 all right. Like I said, like, this is the way to do it. I'm just taking notes over here. Like, say yep, keep your mouth shut. Otherwise, just let her cook. Absolutely.
Yeah. Exactly. So as you're going into that, I mean, she gave you some pretty high praise on online. Oh, what was it, like a stentorian something?
Stentorian voiced doodly bro.
Nice.
I think was the phrase. And it's, you know, I try not to read everything that is said about me, but like that phrase I have taken the liberty of committing to memory, and hopefully I got it right. But like, yeah, that's a big moment for me, for Courtney Love on Instagram to refer to me as a stentorian voiced doodly bro. You know, just put that on my tombstone and be done with it.
So when you're heading into an interview like that and you do want to just naturally let her cook, like, How what was your approach? Is you're like, okay, you know, I probably only am going to get in X amount of questions. Let's make sure I get the right ones, because she's gonna, you know, take that rope and run with it.
Yeah, I just want her to talk. I am under no illusions. You know, in that moment, people just want to hear from her. You know, the less I say, the better. And so I think for me, it was a matter of not interrupting her or talking over her or talking at all, but just being ready for when she did want me to talk, right? Like just following her very closely and sort of trying, and sort of the fun of her a lot of the time is you don't know where she's going and you don't know how these things connect, but they do on a long enough timeline. That's what's so fascinating to me about the way her mind works, you know, just the combination of memory and shit talking, you know, and really astute critical opinion, you know, about music and the connections. You know, she's so smart and she's so funny and she's been through so much, you know, but she's going to get there the way she wants to get there. And it's just my job. It's not even a matter of steering her toward it, because she's getting there and it doesn't benefit anyone to get there any faster than she wants to. Like, just let her do this. But when she asks me a question, you know, when there is a moment, you know, for me to interject, just to be ready for that moment. There's like a hurry up and wait quality to it, where I want to be absolutely present, you know, and following her as closely as possible, but also I am silent, you know what I'm saying? And so it was a really cool thing, you know, like for me to be listening just as much as a person, anyone listening.
And it must have been especially validating that she wanted to have a conversation with you and gave you such, you know, high praise for the way you, honored the, you know, her on that Doll Parts episode, given that she was so highly scrutinized as Kurt Cobain's wife and, you know, in the shadow of that monolith. And the fact that, you know, I guess just for you, just as a critic and as a writer, that must have been really, you know, just validating in a lot of ways. Like, oh, okay, this is working.
I mean, it's validating. It's surreal as hell, man. You know, it's just to have Courtney Love at me on Instagram, to have Courtney Love talking to me on WhatsApp, you know, as I'm sitting and watching a movie with my kids, you know, to be on a Zoom call looking at Courtney Love, you know, as she's singing the alternate lyrics to Smells Like Teen Spirit, you know, reading off Kurt Cobain's handwritten pages of lyrics. I just, there's no way to fully wrap my head around that, you know, but it's incredibly gratifying and it's super kind, you know, and I It was awesome. You know, it's undeniably the high point, or possibly even the high point of my career, just in terms of the weirdness of it, but the coolness of it at the same time.
And was it serendipity again that you hadn't done Smells Like Teen Spirit yet, and then you were able to pair Courtney with that episode? Because you could have easily have done Smells Like Teen Spirit like the first 10 episodes of the show.
I mean, for the longest time, it was going to be the last episode or the second to last. You know, obviously, when I'm looking at a list of 200 songs, you can pull out, you know, 20 to 50 of them that's like, man, I got to do this. Like, you can't do something like this without Biggie, without Tupac, without Nirvana, right? And of course, I'm getting suggestions and what about blank all the time, DMs, emails, and I love those. I love those suggestions. I love to be yelled at for things that I haven't done yet. But obviously, I think, you know, undeniably Smells Like Teen Spirit was the one where people were like, where's the Nirvana episode? And like, I think it's clear to people that this is not a ranked list of songs. You know, we are not going in any sort of coherent order. You know, we're just making this up as we go along. But the Nirvana episode was always looming. And again, it was always going to be last or close to last. But then that got to feel anticlimactic, right? Like, that felt too obvious, you know, and that's what people would expect. And so why don't we drop the episode, you know, when it's still somewhat of a surprise, you know? And we had been on a hiatus for a while. You know, we were coming back. That was the book was announced in that episode, which is not timed that way, but was certainly a very cool serendipitous thing. But it's like, all right, let's do this surprising thing and let's just do it now. And then I think it'll make me work a little harder to still build up the rest of the show, including right now, up to something, right? Like, I don't have as logical a last song as I used to have when Nirvana was still on the table. And so I'm going to have to find an alternate route to end this, you know, in a seemingly, you know, climactic, triumphant type matter. And that's a cool challenge for me. But the other part of that was Courtney. You know, I'd been talking to her for a while. You know, she started asking me if maybe I would want her to do the Nirvana episode. I was like, oh my God, like, of course, like, as long as that's not too painful, too personal. As you say, there's been so much terrible shit written about this person, the scrutiny she was under to this day, you know, and I would never make her relive that, you know, for my little podcast, you know. And I was honored that she asked, and I was honored that she did it. And that also contributed to me just keeping my mouth shut and letting her do it.
Now, over the course of the show's run, you know, the It's Good to Be King episode, I was particularly struck by, and the fatherhoodness of it.
Yeah.
And in a lot of ways, you know, as we spoke about last time, how there is a distinct memoir quality to the totality of the show. And I've over the course of it too, given how you bring in that fatherhood element, I've kind of taken the interpretation that it, in a sense, it's kind of like a manuscript in a way for like to your children, as a, because they might come to a day where they might want to know more about you, and you can kind of like point to these songs in this decade as a means to explain who you are to them. And I don't know, what do you make of that? That's just my interpretation, but I wonder what you might make of that.
No, that's a really interesting idea, you know, and the immediate cheeseball way that I thought to articulate that is like, this podcast explains me way better than it explains the 90s, right? Yeah. You know, like, I didn't start out thinking I'm going to tell so many cool stories about when I was a teenager and people are going to be fascinated. You know, I did not go into this thinking that I'd talk about myself and certainly my children at all. I didn't imagine this memoir quality at all. But I think that gradually came with the evolution too. And that was another element, you know, the podcast aspect, the parasocial aspect, the very personal relationships that people have with music, and the more personal stories people were telling me, the early feedback I was getting. I can see that evolution too, of me very slowly and carefully talking a little bit more about myself as the show goes on. And there's a pretty hard line there for me. And partly that's about, you know, just privacy stuff. You know, it was very obvious from the beginning. Like, I'm not talking about ex-girlfriends in any way, shape, or form, mm-hmm. like, because yeah. they don't need that. But my family, my wife, my kids, like, they come up, but I don't want it to ever feel like I'm using them as content, right? Like, I have all that swirling in my head. But I do think that the Tom Petty episode was a very personal one, you know, obviously, and a culmination of things, you know. And my daughter was born in October 2020 at Halloween, right? And the show had been out for like 2 weeks. And so my daughter is like a physical manifestation of how long this show has been going on. And that's sort of unavoidable. I'm really interested in that idea of this as, you know, what I leave my kids that explains me. Because, of course, the other part of it is like I'm driving my sons to a birthday party, to a laser tag birthday party, and I'm playing Salt and Pepper in the car, and they're like, "Who is this?" I'm like, "It's Salt and Pepper." It's like, "Is this for the podcast?" Yes. You know, like, I've subjected them to each and every artist that I've talked about on this show. And so a really interesting aspect for me, if they have listened to some of the show, you know, and the swearing, you know, and the churlishness, you know, is unfortunate. You know, I am what I am, I guess. But like, they listen to the Tom Petty episode, the They Might Be Giants episode, you know. But it's interesting to me that it's both a roadmap to me and a roadmap to the music that I made them listen to, you know, for the past 3 years. And I wonder if they're anywhere in their heads, do they remember, you know, the 2 weeks that I just played Pantera nonstop. And they're like, "Who is this?" Like, "Pantera, is it for the podcast?" Yes. I like, if they remember that stuff at all, and if this helps with context, or if it's just, you know, dad bloviating, you know, about high school again.
Yeah, because there's an element of, you know, the grandfather who's like published this, you know, like from a vanity press, and it's just like, you know, "Oh, these sure. are my memories. If you want to get to know me a little bit better once I have long passed." And I was like, right. "You know what? This is Rob's footprint, you know, for a particular area that really defines him in a certain ways. And maybe there's a time down the road to be like, "Oh yeah, we can, I remember listening to Pantera on the way to soccer practice," and like that's pretty special.
That's what I hope. I can dream, you know.
Well, Rob, the last thing I want to ask, and this is what I tend to bring these podcasts down for a landing, is just asking the listener, the guest in this case, for a recommendation mm-hmm. of some kind. And I'd extend that to you, whatever you're excited about that you might want to share with the listeners.
A recommendation. I think I'm going to go with a TV show called I'm a Virgo. It is on Amazon Prime. It is directed by Boots Riley, who you may know from The Coup, from the Bay Area rap group The Coup. He made a movie called Sorry to Bother You a couple years ago about like a not televangelist, but just telephone marketers, like this really surreal, like sci-fi comedy. And I'm a Virgo is in that vein. Like, it's about like a 13-foot-tall like teenager, you know, just like a giant, like just set loose in Oakland, California. And that's the aspect that really gets to me. It's a very funny, very weird, you know, a very in-your-face, confrontational kind of show. But what gets to me is the Oakland of it all. You know, I lived in Oakland a couple times, you know, in the early 2000s, you know, and I loved the music, you know, the radio stations, you know, so much, you know. And just to watch this show now of kids now, teenagers now, driving around Oakland, you know, places I remember, Lake Merritt or whatever, and they're listening to E40, you know, they're listening to Too Short, you know, they're listening to whatever. There's like a weird nostalgic pang that I get watching this show. And like, I'm an interloper there. Like, I didn't grow up in Oakland. You know, I'm a kid from Ohio, was in Oakland for a little while and just sort of enjoyed it from like a remove that I was comfortable with. Like, again, like I knew what I knew and I didn't know. But still, like, there's something very special and distinct to me about that time in my life and that place and that music from that place. There's just like a synergy that I never got from any other place or time in my life. And that's another present element in this show, which is otherwise just so surreal and so funny and so cool. So I'll say I'm a Virgo.
Fantastic. Well, Rob, thank you so much for carving out the time to do this amidst your
again, it's great to talk to you
tour.
Again.
Yeah.
It is getting a little harrowing, the sound of my voice at this volume and length, you know, but I'm having a great time. It's great to talk to you again, and I really appreciate it.
Oh, that was great. Ah, man, that's cool. Thanks to Rob. Name of the book again, 60 Songs That Explain the 90s. It's published by 12. Get it for the Gen Xer in your life or your mom. Thanks to the Power of Narrative Conference for promotional support. You have like 2 more weeks to sign up. And if you go to combeyond.bu.edu and you use narrative25, you get 25% off your tuition, which is like, it's a lot of burrito money. That much I know. I haven't gotten feedback on my biography yet. I got a little tiny bit of feedback, so it's not entirely true, which is, it's kind of an unsettling amount of feedback because it's, well, not receiving any feedback. It's a little, wow, unsettling because it's taking longer than I think either of us expected, and that's never a good sign. I got a note that did say, you don't want people to pay attention to the writing, which on its surface is a total bummer because we often link the writing quote with the person quote, unquote. Put your quotes wherever you want. I did the writing, therefore the writing is me. It's the same advice I got a few years ago from the same person saying, don't get writerly on me. God damn it, I seem to have a pitfall. It's great advice. But when we read reviews or read scholars or experts or bloggers talk about people we admire, so often we're flooded with the laurels of what beautiful language and writing it is. I don't know, from say Jane Austen to F. Scott Fitzgerald, you know, long dead beautiful writers. Like the writing is, and part of the reason we got into this mess was to maybe earn that kind of attention. Yeah, nothing lights up a writer better than someone telling them that they love the writing. That and checks clearing, of course, and arriving in a timely manner. So what is good writing? Maybe this is my best way to explain this, and I will use a couple different metaphors. I might even mix metaphors because that's bad writing unless you call attention to it, and then it's intentional, and that's good writing? Anyway, I don't know. Okay, good writing still has elements of voice and style, but not too much voice and too much style. When I watch a Wes Anderson movie, I know it's a Wes Anderson movie, or a Christopher Nolan movie, or a Sofia Coppola, or Tarantino. Good writing dissolves. It's the solvent. It makes the story possible, but doesn't call unnecessary attention to itself. Good writing is surrendering to the story. David Gran is a master, and you wouldn't confuse his prose as being overly written, overwrought, or even quote-unquote beautiful. But there's nobody better, certainly in nonfiction, and maybe even extending over to fiction land. You find enough great details through your research and your interviewing, and then all you're doing is taking dictation, you know, from all that material. And yeah, you zhuzh it up a little bit. You throw in a little bit of seasoning, but you don't slam 10 grams of finishing salt on the dish. It's like a couple grains. And that's elevation. That is tasty. So how you put your stamp on that is voice and style. But like I said, it can't be too much. And at times in the early drafts, you are so often too much. There's a balance, and that's what the rewrites are for. And the rewrite, and the rewrite, and the rewrite, and the rewrite. And damn it, won't the deadline come? Stay wild, CNFers, and if you can't do, interview. See ya.